Blind Sight, Disc 2.
This is what my father could not unmake. This is what I am. I am the bridge between the bleeding edge and the dead center. I stand between the Wizard of Oz and the man behind the curtain. I am the curtain. I'm not an entirely new breed. My roots reach back to the dawn of civilization, but those precursors served a different function, a less honorable one. They only greased the wheels of social stability. They would sugarcoat unpleasant truths or inflate imaginary bogeymen for political expedience. They were vital enough in their way. Not even the most heavily armed police state can exert brute force on all of its citizens all of the time. Meme management is so much subtler. The rose-tinted refraction of perceived reality, the contagious fear of threatening alternatives. There have always been those tasked with the rotation of informational topologies, but throughout most of history, they had little to do with increasing its clarity. The new millennium changed all that. We've surpassed ourselves now. We're exploring terrain beyond the limits of merely human understanding. Sometimes its contours, even in conventional space, are just too intricate for our brains to track. Other times, its very axes extend into dimensions inconceivable to minds built for fucking and fighting on some prehistoric grassland. So many things constrain us from so many directions. The most altruistic and sustainable philosophies fail before the brute brainstem imperative of self-interest. Subtle and elegant equations predict the behavior of the quantum world, but none can explain it. After 4,000 years, we can't even prove that reality exists beyond the mind of the first-person dreamer. We have such need of intellects greater than our own. But we're not very good at building them. The forced matings of minds and electrons succeed and fail with equal spectacle. Our hybrids become as brilliant as savants and as autistic. We graft people to prosthetics, make their overloaded motor strips juggle meat and machinery, and shake our heads when their fingers twitch and their tongues stutter. Computers bootstrap their own offspring, grow so wise and incomprehensible that their communiques assume the hallmarks of dementia, unfocused and irrelevant to the barely intelligent creatures left behind. And when your surpassing creations find the answers you asked for, you can't understand their analysis, and you can't verify their answers. You have to take their word on faith. Or you use information theory to flatten it for you, to squash the tesseract into two dimensions and the Klein bottle into three, to simplify reality and pray to whatever god survived the millennium that your honorable twisting of the truth hasn't ruptured any of its load-bearing pylons. You hire people like me, the crossbred progeny of profilers and proof assistants and information theorists. In formal settings, you'd call me a synthesist. On the street, you'd call me Jargonaut, or Poppy, if you're one of those savants whose hard-won truths are being bastardized and lobotomized for powerful know-nothings interested only in market share. You might call me a mole or a chaperone. If you were Isaac Spindle, you'd call me Commissar. And while the jibe would be a friendly one, it would also be more than that. I've never convinced myself that we made the right choice. I can cite the usual justifications in my sleep, talk endlessly about the rotational topology of information and the irrelevance of semantic comprehension, but after all the words, I'm still not sure. I don't know if anyone else is either. Maybe it's just some grand consensual con, marks and players all in league. We won't admit that our creations are beyond us. They may speak in tongues, but our priests can read those signs. Gods leave their algorithms carved into the mountainside, but it's just little old me bringing the tablets down to the masses, and I don't threaten anyone. Maybe the singularity happened years ago. We just don't want to admit we were left behind. All kinds of animals coming here. Occasional demons, too. Ian Anderson, Catfish Rising. The third wave, they called us. All in the same boat, driving into the long dark courtesy of a bleeding-edge prototype crash graduated from the simulators a full 18 months ahead of schedule. In a less fearful economy, such violence to the timetable would have bankrupted 4 countries and 15 multi-cores. The first 2 waves came out of the gate in even more of a hurry. I didn't find out what had happened to them until 30 minutes before the briefing, when Saresti released the telemetry into consensus. Then I opened wide. Experience flooded up my inlays and spilled across my parietal cortex in glorious high-density fast-forward. Even now I can bring those data back, fresh as the day they were recorded. I'm there. I'm them. I'm unmanned. I am disposable. I am souped up and stripped down, a telematter drive with a couple of cameras bolted to the front end, pushing G's that would turn meat to jelly. I sprint joyously toward the darkness, my twin brother a stereoscopic 100 clicks to starboard, dual streams of backspat pions boosting us to relativity before poor old Theseus had even crawled past Mars. But now, 6 billion kilometers to stern, mission control turns off the tap and leaves us coasting. The comet swells in our sights, a frozen enigma sweeping its signal across the sky like a lighthouse beam. We bring rudimentary senses to bear and stare it down on 1,000 wavelengths. We've lived for this moment. We see an erratic wobble that speaks of recent collisions. We see scars, smooth, icy expanses where once acneed skin is liquefied and refrozen, far too recently for the insignificant sun at our backs to be any kind of suspect. We see an astronomical impossibility, a comet with a heart of refined iron. Burns Caulfield sings as we glide past. Not to us. It ignores our passage as it ignored our approach. It sings to someone else entirely. Perhaps we'll meet that audience someday. Perhaps they're waiting in the desolate wastelands ahead of us. Mission control flips us onto our backs, keeps us fixed on target past any realistic hope of acquisition. They send last-ditch instructions, squeeze our fading signals for every last bit among the static. I can sense their frustration, their reluctance to let us go. Once or twice, we're even asked if some judicious mix of thrust and gravity might let us linger here a bit longer. But deceleration is for pansies. We're headed for the stars. Bye, Bernsey. Bye, Mission Control. Bye, Sol. See you at heat death. Warily, we close on target. There are 3 of us in the second wave. Slower than our predecessors, yes, but still so much faster than anything flesh-constrained. We are weighed down by payloads which make us virtually omniscient. We see on every wavelength, from radio to string. Our autonomous microprobes measure everything our masters anticipated. Tiny onboard assembly lines can build tools from the atoms up to assess the things they did not. Atoms, scavenged from where we are, join with ions beamed from where we were. Thrust and material accumulate in our bellies. This extra mass has slowed us, but midpoint braking maneuvers have slowed us even more. The last half of this journey has been a constant fight against momentum from the first. It is not an efficient way to travel. In less hurried times, we would have built early to some optimal speed, perhaps slung around a convenient planet for a little extra oomph, coasted most of the way. But time is pressing, so we burn at both ends. We must reach our destination. We cannot afford to pass it by, cannot afford the kamikaze exuberance of the first wave. They merely glimpsed the lay of the land. We must map it down to the motes. We must be more responsible. Now, slowing toward orbit, we see everything they saw and more. We see the scabs and the impossible iron core. We hear the singing. And there, just beneath the comet's frozen surface, we see structure, an infiltration of architecture into geology. We are not yet close enough to squint, and radar is too long in the tooth for fine detail. But we are smart, and there are three of us, widely separated in space. The wavelengths of three radar sources can be calibrated to interfere at some predetermined point of convergence, and those tripartite echoes, hologrammatically remixed, will increase resolution by a factor of 27. Burns Caulfield stops singing the moment we put our plan into action. In the next instant, I go blind. It's a temporary aberration, a reflexive amping of filters to compensate for the overload. My arrays are back online in seconds, diagnostics green within and without. I reach out to the others, confirm identical experiences, identical recoveries. We are all still fully functional, unless the sudden increase in ambient ion density is some kind of sensory artifact. We are ready to continue our investigation of Burns Caulfield. The only real problem is that Burns Caulfield seems to have disappeared. Theseus carried no regular crew, no navigators or engineers, no one to swab the decks, no meat wasted on tasks that machinery orders of mag smaller could perform orders of mag better. Let superfluous deckhands weigh down other ships if the non-ascendant hordes need to attach some pretense of usefulness to their lives. Let them infest vessels driven only by commercial priorities. The only reason we were here was because nobody had yet optimized software for first contact. Bound past the edge of the solar system, already freighted with the fate of the world, Theseus wasted no mass on self-esteem. So here we were, rehydrated and squeaky clean, Isaac Spindle to study the aliens, the gang of four, Susan James and her secondary, Persani, to talk to them, Major Amanda Bates was here to fight, if necessary, and Yuka Saristi to command us all, to move us like chess pieces on some multidimensional game board that only vampires could see. He'd arrayed us around a conference table that warped gently through the commons, keeping a discreet and constant distance from the curved deck beneath. The whole drum was furnished an early concave, tricked unwary and hungover brains into thinking they were looking at the world through fisheye lenses. In deference to the creakiness of the nouveau undead, it spun at a mere fifth of a G, but it was just warming up. We'd be at half grav in 6 hours. Stuck there for 18 out of every 24 until the ship decided we were fully recovered. For the next few days, freefall would be a rare and blessed thing. Light sculptures appeared on the tabletop. Saristi could have fed the information directly to our inlays. The whole briefing could have gone through consensus without the need to assemble physically in the same place. But if you want to be sure everyone's paying attention, you bring them together. Spindle leaned in conspiratorially at my side. Or maybe the bloodsucker just gets off seeing all this meat in close quarters, eh? If Saristi heard, he didn't show it, not even to me. He pointed to a dark heart at the center of the display, his eyes lost behind black glass.
OAS object, infrared emitter, methane class.
On the display, it was nothing. Our apparent destination was a black disk, a round absence of stars. In real life, it weighed in at over 10 Jupiters and measured 20% wider at the belly. It was directly in our path, too small to burn, too remote for the reflection of distant sunlight, too heavy for a gas giant, too light for a brown dwarf. When did that show up? Bate squeezed her rubber ball in one hand, the knuckles whitening.
X-ray spike appears during the 76 microwave survey.
6 years before firefall.
Never confirmed, never reacquired. Like a torsion flare from an L-class dwarf, but we should see anything big enough to generate that kind of effect, and the sky's dark on that bearing. IAU calls it a statistical artifact.
Spindle's eyebrows drew together like courting caterpillars.
What changed?
Saristi smiled faintly, keeping his mouth closed.
The metabase gets crowded after firefall. Everyone's skittish, looking for clues. After Burns' call field explodes,
he clicked at the back of his throat.
Turns out the spike might arise from a subdwarf object after all, if the magnetosphere's torqued enough.
Bates, torqued by what?
Don't know.
Layers of statistical inference piled up on the table while Saristi sketched background. Even with a solid bearing and half the world's attention, the object had hidden from all but the most intensive search. 1,000 telescopic snapshots had been stacked one on another and squeezed through 12 filters before something emerged from the static, just below the 3-meter band and the threshold of certainty. For the longest time, it hadn't even been real, just a probabilistic ghost until Theseus got close enough to collapse the waveform. A quantum particle, heavy as 10 Jupiters. Earthbound cartographers were calling it Big Ben. Theseus had barely passed Saturn's orbit when it showed up in the residuals. That discovery would have been moot for anyone else. No other ship caught en route could have packed enough fuel for anything but the long, dejected loop back home. But Theseus's thin, infinitely attenuate fuel line reached all the way back to the sun. She could turn on the proverbial dime. We changed course in our sleep, and the Icarus stream tracked our moves like a cat after prey, feeding us at light speed. And here we were.
Talk about long shots, Spindle grumbled.
Across the table, Bates flicked her wrist. Her ball sailed over my head. I heard it bounce off the deck. Not the deck, something in me amended. Handrail. We're assuming the comet was a deliberate decoy, then. Saristi nodded. The ball ricocheted back into my line of sight high overhead and disappeared briefly behind the spinal bundle, looping through some eccentric, counterintuitive parabola into the drum's feeble grav.
So they want to be left alone.
Saristi steepled his fingers and turned his face in her direction.
That your recommendation?
She wished it was. No, sir, I'm just saying that Burns Caulfield took a lot of resources and effort to set up. Whoever built it obviously values their anonymity and has the technology to protect it. The ball bounced one last time and wobbled back toward the commons. Bates half hopped from her seat. She floated briefly, barely catching it on its way past. There remained a newborn animal awkwardness to her movements, half Coriolis, half residual rigor. Still, a big improvement in 4 hours. The rest of the humans were barely past the walking stage.
Maybe it wasn't much trouble for them at all, eh?
Spindle was musing.
Maybe it was dead easy.
In which case, they might or might not be as xenophobic, but they're even more advanced. We don't want to rush into this. Saristi turned back to the simmering graphics.
So?
Bates kneaded the recovered ball with her fingertips. The second mouse gets the cheese. We may have blown our top-of-the-line recon in the Kuiper, but we don't have to go in blind. Send in our own drones along separate vectors. Hold off on a close approach until at least we know whether we're dealing with friendlies or hostiles.
James shook her head. If they were hostile, they could have packed the Fireflies with antimatter, or sent one big object instead of 60,000 little ones, let the impact take us out?
The fireflies only imply an initial curiosity, Bates said. Who knows if they liked what they saw?
What if this whole diversion theory's just so much shit?
I turned, briefly startled. James's mouth had made the words. Sasha had spoken them.
You want to stay hidden? You don't light up the sky with fucking fireworks, she continued. You don't need a diversion if nobody's looking for you, and nobody's looking for you if you lie low. If they were so curious, they could have just snuck in a spy cam.
Risks detection? The vampire said mildly. Hate to break it, Yuka, but the fireflies didn't exactly slip under the ray.
Saresti opened his mouth, closed it again. Filed teeth, briefly visible, clicked audibly behind his face. Tabletop graphics reflected off his visor, a band of writhing polychrome distortions where eyes should be. Sasha shut up. Saresti continued.
They trade stealth for speed. By the time you react, they already have what they want.
He spoke quietly, patiently, a well-fed predator explaining the rules of the game to prey that really should know better. The longer it takes me to track you down, the more hope you have of escaping. But Sasha had already fled. Her surfaces had scattered like a flock of panicked starlings, and the next time Susan James's mouth opened, it was Susan James who spoke through it. Sasha's aware of the current paradigm, Yuka. She's simply worried that it might be wrong.
Got another we could trade it on?
Spindle wondered.
More options? Longer warranty?
I don't know, James sighed. I guess not. It's just odd that they'd want to actively mislead us. I hoped they were merely, well, she spread her hands. Probably no big deal. I'm sure they'll still be willing to talk if we handle the introductions right. We just need to be a little more cautious, perhaps.
Saresti unfolded himself from his chair and loomed over us.
We go in. We know what weighs against further delay.
Bates frowned and pitched her ball back into orbit. Sir, all we actually know is that an OASA emitter's in our path. We don't even know if there's anyone there.
There is, Saresti said. They expect us.
Nobody spoke for a few seconds. Someone's joints cracked in the silence. Spindle began. Without looking, Saresti flicked out his arm and snatched Bates' returning ball from the air.
Ladar pings Theseus 4 hours 48 minutes ago. We respond with an identical signal. Nothing. Probe launches half hour before we wake up. We don't go in blind, but we don't wait. They see us already. Longer we wait, greater risk of countermeasures.
I looked at the dark, featureless placeholder on the table. Bigger than Jupiter, and we couldn't even see it yet. Something in the shadow of that mass had just reached out with casual, unimaginable precision and tapped us on the nose with a laser beam. This was not going to be an even match. Spindle spoke for all of us.
You knew that all along? You're telling us now?
This time, Saresti's smile was wide and toothy. It was as though a gash had opened in the lower half of his face. Maybe it was a predator thing. He just couldn't help playing with his food. It wasn't so much the way they looked. The elongate limbs, the pale skin, the canines and the extended mandible. Noticeable, yes, even alien, but not disturbing, not frightening. Not even the eyes, really. The eyes of dogs and cats shine in the darkness. We don't shiver at the sight. Not the way they looked, the way they moved. Something in the reflexes, maybe. The way they held their limbs, like mantis limbs, long jointed things you just knew could reach out and snatch you from right across the room any time they felt like it. When Saresti looked at me, really looked, naked-eyed, unfiltered by the visor, a 500,000 years just melted away. The fact that he was extinct meant nothing. The fact that we'd come so far, grown strong enough to resurrect our own nightmares to serve us, meant nothing. The genes aren't fooled. They know what to fear. Of course, you had to experience it in person. Robert Paglini knew the theory of vampires down to the molecules, but even with all those technical specs in his head, he never really got it. He called me before we left. I hadn't been expecting it. Ever since the roster had been announced, our watches had blocked calls from anyone not explicitly contact listed. I'd forgot that Pag had been. We hadn't spoken since Chelsea. I'd given up on ever hearing from him again. But there he was. "Podman!" he smiled, a tentative overture. "It's good to see you," I said, because that's what people said in similar situations. "Yeah, well, I saw your name in the news. You made it big for a baseline." "Not so big." "Crap, you're the vanguard of the human race. You're our first, last, and only hope against the unknown. Man, you showed 'em." He held his fist up and shook it, vicariously triumphant. Showing them had become a cornerstone of Robert Paglino's life. He'd really made it work for him, too. Overcome the handicap of a natural birth with retrofits and enhancements and sheer bloody-mindedness. In a world in which humanity had become redundant in unprecedented numbers, we'd both retained the status of another age, working professional. "So you're taking orders from a vamp," he said now. "Talk about fighting fire with fire." "I guess it's practice, until we run up against the real thing." He laughed. I couldn't imagine why, but I smiled back anyway. It was good to see him. "So what are they like?" Pag asked. "Vampires? I don't know. Just met my first one yesterday." "And?" "Hard to read. Didn't even seem to be aware of his surroundings sometimes. He seemed to be off in his own little world." "He's aware, all right. Those things are so fast, it's scary. You know they can hold both aspects of a Necker cube in their heads at the same time?" The term rang a bell. I subtitled and saw the thumbnail of a familiar wireframe box. Now I remembered. Classic ambiguous illusion. Sometimes the shaded panel seemed to be in front, sometimes behind. The perspective flipped back and forth as you watched. "You or I, we can only see it one way or the other," Pag said. "Vamps see it both ways at once. Do you have any idea what kind of an edge that gives them?" "Not enough of one." "Touché. But hey, not their fault neutral traits get fixed in small populations." "I don't know if I'd call the crucifix glitch neutral." "It was at first. How many intersecting right angles do you see in nature?" He waved one dismissive hand. "Anyway, that's not the point. The point is they can do something that's neurologically impossible for us humans. They can hold simultaneous multiple worldviews, Podman. They just see things we have to work out step by step. They don't have to think about it. You know, there isn't a single baseline human who could tell you, just off the top of their heads, every prime number between 1 and 1 billion. In the old days, only a few autistics could do shit like that." "He never uses the past tense," I murmured. "Huh? Oh, that," Pag nodded. "They never experience the past tense. It's just another thread to them. They don't remember stuff. They relive it."
"What, like a post-traumatic flashback?"
"Not so traumatic," he grimaced. "Not for them, at least."
"So this is obviously your current hotspot. Vampires?"
"Pod, vampires are the capital H hotspot for anyone with a neuro in their CV. I'm just doing a couple of histology papers. Pattern matching receptors, Mexican hat arrays, reward irrelevance filters. The eyes, basically."
"Right," I hesitated. "Those kind of throw you, No shit, Peg nodded knowingly. That tap lucidum of theirs, that shine, scary.
He shook his head, impressed all over again at the recollection. You've never met one, I surmised.
What, in the flesh? I'd give my left ball. Why?
It's not the shine, it's the... I groped for a word that fit. The attitude, maybe.
Yeah, he said after a bit. I guess sometimes you just gotta be there, huh? Which is why I envy you, Podman.
You shouldn't.
I should. Even if you never meet whoever sent the flies, you're in for one Christly research opportunity with that Saristy, is it?
Wasted on me. The only neuro in my files under medical history. He laughed.
Anyway, like I said, I just saw your name in the headlines and I figured, hey, the man's leaving in a couple of months. I should probably stop waiting around for him to call.
It had been over 2 years. I didn't think I'd get through. I thought you'd shitlisted me.
Nah, never.
He looked down, though, and fell silent.
But you should have called her, he said at last.
I know.
She was dying. You should have...
There wasn't time. He let the lie sit there for a while.
Anyway, he said at last, I just wanted to wish you luck.
Which wasn't exactly true either. Thanks, I appreciate that.
Kick their alien asses, if aliens have asses.
There's 5 of us, Pag. 9 if you count the backups. We're not exactly an army.
Just an expression, fellow mammal. Bury the hatchet, damn the torpedoes, soothe the serpent.
Raise the white flag, I thought.
I guess you're busy, he said.
Look, you want to get together in airspace? I haven't been to Qubits in a while.
Love to, Pod. Fortunately, I'm in Mankoya, Splice and Dice Workshop.
What, you mean physically?
Cutting-edge research, old-school habits.
Too bad.
Anyway, I'll let you go. Just wanted, you know.
Thanks, I said again.
So, you know. Bye,
Robert Paglino told me. Which was, when you got down to it, the reason he'd called. He wasn't expecting another chance. Pag blamed me for the way it had ended with Chelsea. Fair enough. I blamed him for the way it began. He'd gone into neuroeconomics at least partly because his childhood buddy had turned into a pod person before his eyes. I'd ended up in synthesis for roughly the same reason. Our paths had diverged, and we didn't see each other in the flesh all that often. But 2 decades after I'd brutalized a handful of children on his behalf, Robert Paglino was still my best and only friend.
You need to seriously thaw out, he told me, and I know just the lady to handle the oven mitts.
That is perhaps the worst use of metaphor in the history of human language, I said.
Seriously, Pod, she'll be good for you. A counterbalance, ease you a bit closer to the comfy mean, you know?
No, Pag, I don't.
What is she, another neuroeconomist?
Neuroestheticist, he said. There's still a market for those? I couldn't imagine how. Why pay to tweak your compatibility with some significant other when significant others themselves were so out of fashion?
Not much of one, Pag admitted. Fact is, she's pretty much retired, but she's still got the tools, my man. Very thigmotactic. Likes all her relationships face-to-face and in the flesh.
I don't know, Pag. Sounds like work.
Not like your work. She's got to be easier than the bleeding composites you front for. She's smart, she's sexy, and she's nicely inside the standard div except for the personal contact thing, which is not so much outright perversion as charming fetish. In your case, it could even be therapeutic.
If I wanted therapy, I'd see a therapist.
She does a bit of that too, actually.
Yeah? And then despite myself. Any good? He looked me up and down. No one's that good. That's not what this is. I just figured you two would click. Chelsea is one of the few who might not be completely put off by your intimacy issues.
Everyone's got intimacy issues these days, in case you hadn't noticed. He must have. The population had been dropping for decades.
I was being euphemistic. I meant your aversion to general human contact.
Making it euphemistic to call you human? He grinned.
Different deal. We got history.
No thanks.
Too late. She's already en route to the appointed place.
You're an asshole, Peg.
The tightest.
Which was how I found myself intrusively face to face in an airspace lounge south of Beth and Bear. The lighting was low and indirect, creeping from under the seats and the edges of tables. The chromatics, this afternoon at least, were defiantly long wave. It was a place where baselines could pretend to see in infrared. So I pretended for a moment, assessing the woman in the corner booth. Gangly and glorious, a half dozen ethnicities coexisting peacefully with no single voice dominant. Something glowed on her cheek, a faint emerald staccato against the ambient redshift. Her hair floated in a diffuse ebony cloud about her head. As I neared, I caught occasional glints of metal within that nimbus, the threads of a static generator purveying the illusion of weightlessness. In normal light, her blood-red skin would doubtless shift down to the fashionable butterscotch of the unrepentant mongrel. She was attractive, but so was everyone in this kind of light. The longer the wavelength, the softer the focus. There's a reason fuckcubbies don't come with fluorescent lights. You will not fall for this, I told myself.
Chelsea, she said.
Her little finger rested on one of the table's inset trickle chargers. Former neuroestheticist, presently a parasite on the body economic thanks to genes and machines on the cutting edge. The glow on her cheek flapped bright, lazy wings, a tattoo, a bioluminescent butterfly. Siri, I said. Freelance synthesist, indentured servant to the genes and machines that turned you into a parasite. She waved at the empty seat. I took it, assessing the system before me, sizing up the best approach for a fast yet diplomatic disconnect. The set of her shoulders told me she enjoyed lightscapes and was embarrassed to admit it. Monahan was her favorite artist. She thought herself a natural girl because she'd stayed on chemical libidinals all these years, even though a synaptic edit would have been simpler. She reveled in her own inconsistency, a woman whose professional machinery edited thought itself, yet mistrustful of the dehumanizing impact of telephones. Innately affectionate, and innately afraid of unreturned affection, and indomitably unwilling to let any of that stop her. She liked what she saw when she looked at me. She was a little afraid of that, too. Chelsea gestured at my side of the table. The touchpads there glowed a soft, dissonant sapphire in the bloody light, like a set of splayed fingerprints.
Good dope here. Extra hydroxyl on the ring or something.
Assembly line neurofarm doesn't do much for me. It's optimized for people with more meat in their heads. I fingered one of the pads for appearances and barely felt the tingle.
So, a synthesist explaining the incomprehensible to the indifferent.
I smiled on cue. More like bridging the gap between the people who make the breakthroughs and the people who take the credit for them. She smiled back.
So how do you do it? All those optimized frontal lobes and refits. I mean, if they're incomprehensible, how do you comprehend them?
It helps to find pretty much everyone else incomprehensible, too. Provides experience. There. That should force a bit of distance. It didn't. She thought I was joking. I could see her lining up to push for more details, to ask questions about what I did, which would lead to questions about me, which would lead... Tell me what it's like,
I said smoothly. Rewiring people's heads for a living? Chelsea grimaced. The butterfly on her cheek fluttered nervously at the motion, wings brightening. God, you make it sound like we turn them into zombies or something. They're just tweaks, mainly. Changing taste in music or cuisine, you know, optimizing mate compatibility. It's all completely reversible. There aren't drugs for that? No. Too much developmental variation between brains. Our targeting is really fine scale. But it's not all microsurgery and fried synapses, you know. You'd be surprised how much rewiring can be done non-invasively. You can start all sorts of cascades just by playing certain sounds in the right order, or showing images with the right balance of geometry and emotion. I assume those are new techniques? Not really. Rhythm and music hang their hats on the same basic principle. We just turned art into science. Yeah, but when? The recent past, certainly. Sometime within the past 20 years or so. Her voice grew suddenly quiet. Robert told me about your operation. Some kind of viral epilepsy, right? Back when you were just a tyke. I'd never explicitly asked him to keep it a secret. What was the difference, anyway? I'd made a full recovery. Besides, Pag still thought that it happened to someone else. I don't know your specifics, Chelsea continued gently. But from the sound of it, non-invasive techniques wouldn't have helped. I'm sure they only did what they had to do. I tried to suppress the thought and couldn't. I like this woman. I felt something then. A strange, unfamiliar sensation that somehow loosened my vertebrae. The chair felt subtly, indefinably more comfortable at my back. Anyway, my silence had thrown her off stride. Haven't done it much since the bottom dropped out of the market. But it did leave me with a fondness for face-to-face encounters, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Pag said you took your sex in the first person. She nodded. I'm very old school. You okay with that? I wasn't certain. I was a virgin in the real world, one of the few things I still had in common with the rest of civilized society. In principle, I guess. It just seems a lot of effort for not as much payoff, you know? Don't I? She smiled. Real fuck buddies aren't airbrushed. Got all these needs and demands that you can't edit out. How can you blame anyone for saying no thanks to all that? Now there's a choice. You gotta wonder how our parents ever stayed together sometimes. You gotta wonder why they did. I felt myself sinking deeper into the chair, wondered again at this strange new sensation. Chelsea had said the dopamine was tweaked. That was probably it. She leaned forward, not coy, not coquettish, not breaking eye contact for an instant in the long wave gloom. I could smell the lemony tang of pheromones and synthetics mingling on her skin. But there are advantages, too, once you learn the moves, she said. The body's got a long memory. And you do realize there's no trickler under your right finger there. Don't you, Siri? I looked. My left arm was slightly extended, index finger touching one of the trickle pads, and my right had mirrored the motion while I wasn't watching, its own finger tapping uselessly on blank tabletop. I pulled it back. Bit of a bilateral twitch, I admitted. The body creeps into symmetrical poses when I'm not looking. I waited for a joke, or at least a raised eyebrow. Chelsea just nodded and resumed her thread. So, if you're game for this, so am I. I've never been entangled with a synthesist before. Jargonaut's fine. I'm not proud. Don't you just always know just exactly what to say? She cocked her head at me. So your name, what's it mean? Relaxed, that was it. I felt relaxed. I don't know. It's just a name. Well, it's not good enough.
If we're going to be swapping spit for any length of time, you got to get a name that means something. And we were, I realized. Chelsea had decided while I wasn't looking. I could have stopped her right there, told her what a bad idea this was, apologized for any misunderstanding. But then there'd be wounded looks and hurt feelings and guilt, because after all, if I wasn't interested, why the hell had I even shown up? She seemed nice. I didn't want to hurt her. Just for a while, I told myself. It'll be an experience. I think I'll call you Cygnus, Chelsea said. The swan? I said. A bit precious, but it could have been worse. She shook her head. Black hole. Cygnus X1. Ah. A dark, dense object that sucks up the light and destroys everything in its path. Thanks a whole fucking lot. Why? I'm not sure. Something dark about you. She shrugged and gave me a great toothy grin. But it's not unattractive. And let me give you a tweak or two. I bet you'd grow right out of it. Pag admitted afterward, a bit sheepishly, that maybe I should have read that as a warning sign. Live and learn. Leaders are visionaries with a poorly developed sense of fear and no concept of the odds against them. Robert Jarvik. Our scout fell toward orbit, watching Ben. We fell days behind, watching the scout. And that was all we did. Sit in Theseus's belly while the system streamed telemetry to our inlays. Essential, irreplaceable, mission critical, we might as well have been ballast during that first approach. We passed Ben's Rayleigh limit. Theseus squinted at a meager emission spectrum and saw a rogue halo element from Canis Major, a dismembered remnant of some long-lost galaxy that had drifted into ours and ended up as roadkill uncounted billions of years ago. We were closing on something from outside the Milky Way. The probe arced down and in, drew close enough for false color enhance. Ben's surface brightened to a seething parfait of high-contrast bands against a diamond-hard starscape. Something twinkled there, faint sparkles on endless overcast. Lightning? James wondered. Spindle shook his head. Meteorites. Must be a lot of rock in the neighborhood. Wrong color, Sarasti said. He was not physically among us. He was back in his tent, hardlined into the captain. But consensus put him anywhere on board he wanted to be. Morphometrics scrolled across my inlays, mass, diameter, mean density. Ben's day lasted 7 hours, 12 minutes. Diffuse but massive accretion belt circling the equator, more torus than ring, extending almost 500,000 kilometers from the cloud tops. The pulverized corpses of moons, perhaps, ground down to leftovers. Meteorites, Spindle grinned. Told you. He seemed to be right. Increasing proximity smeared many of those pinpoint sparkles into bright ephemeral hyphens, scratching the atmosphere. Closer to the poles, cloud bands flickered with dim, intermittent flashes of electricity. Weak radio emission peaks at 31 and 400 meters. Outer atmosphere heavy with methane and ammonia, lithium, water, carbon monoxide in abundance. Ammonia hydrogen sulfide, alkali halide mixing locally in those torn, swirling clouds. Neutral alkalis in the upper layers. By now, even Theseus could pick those things out from a distance, but our scout was close enough to see filigree. It no longer saw a disk. It gazed down at a dark convex wall and seething layers of red and brown, saw faint stains of anthracene and pyrene. One of a myriad meteorite contrails scorched Ben's face directly ahead. For a moment, I thought I could see even the tiny dark speck at its core, but sudden static scratched the feed. Bates cursed softly.
The image blurred, then steadied as the probe pitched its voice higher up the spectrum. Unable to make itself heard above the long-wave din, now it spoke down a laser. And still it stuttered. Keeping it aligned across a million fluctuating kilometers should have posed no problem at all. Our respective trajectories were known parabolas, our relative positions infinitely predictable at any time t. But the meteorite's contrail jumped and skittered on the feed, as if the beam were being repeatedly, infinitesimally knocked out of alignment. Incandescent gas blurred its details. I doubted that even a rock-steady image would have offered any sharp edges for a human eye to hold on to. Still, there was something wrong about it somehow, something about the tiny black dot at the core of that fading brightness, something that some primitive part of my mind refused to accept as natural. The image lurched again and flashed to black and didn't return. "Probe's fried," Bates reported. "Spike there at the end, like it hit a Parker spiral, but with a really tight wind." I didn't need to call up subtitles. It was obvious in the set of her face, the sudden creases between her eyebrows. She was talking about a magnetic field. "It's," she began, and stopped as a number popped up in consensus. 11.2 Tesla. "Holy shit," Spindle whispered. "Is that right?" Sarasti clicked from the back of his throat and the back of the ship. A moment later, he served up an instant replay, those last few seconds of telemetry zoomed and smoothed and contrast-enhanced from visible light down to deep infrared. There was that same dark shard called in flame. There was the contrail burning in its wake. Now it dimmed as the object skipped off the denser atmosphere beneath and regained altitude. Within moments, the heat trace had faded entirely. The thing that had burned at its center rose back into space, a fading ember. A great conic scoop at its front end gaped like a mouth. Stubby fins disfigured an ovoid abdomen. Ben lurched and went out all over again. "Meteorites," Bates said dryly. The thing had left me with no sense of scale. It could have been an insect or an asteroid. "How big?" I whispered, a split second before the answer appeared on my inlays. 400 meters along the major axis. Ben was safely distant in our sights once more, a dark dim disk centered in Theseus's forward viewfinder. But I remembered the close-up. A twinkling orb of black-hearted fires, a face gashed and pockmarked, endlessly wounded, endlessly healing. There'd been thousands of the things. Theseus shivered along her length. It was just a pulse of decelerating thrust, but for that one moment, I imagined I knew how she felt. We headed in and hedged our bets. Theseus weaned herself with a 98-second burn, edged us into some vast arc that might, with a little effort, turn into an orbit, or into a quick, discreet flyby if the neighborhood turned out to be a little too rough. The Icarus stream fell invisibly to port, its unswerving energy lost to space-time. Our city-sized, molecule-thick parasol wound down and packed itself away until next time the ship got thirsty. Antimatter stockpiles began dropping immediately. This time we were alive to watch it happen. The dip was infinitesimal, but there was something disquieting about the sudden appearance of that minus sign on the display. We could have retained the apron strings, left a buoy behind in the telematter stream to bounce energy down the well after us. Susan James wondered why we hadn't. "Too risky," Sarasti said without elaboration. Spindle leaned in James's direction. "Why give him something else to shoot at, eh?" We sent more probes ahead, though,
spat them out hard and fast and too fuel-constrained for anything but fly-by and self-destruct. They couldn't take their eyes off the machines swinging around Big Ben. Theseus stared her own unblinking stare, more distant though more acute. But if those high divers even knew we were out there, they ignored us completely. We tracked them across the closing distance, watched them swoop and loop through a million parabolas at a million angles. We never saw them collide, not with each other, not with the cauldron of rock tumbling around Ben's equator. Every perigee dipped briefly into atmosphere. There they burned and slowed and accelerated back into space, their anterior scoops glowing with residual heat. Bates grabbed a consensus image, drew highlights and a conclusion around the front end. Scramjet. We tracked nearly 400,000 in less than 2 days. That appeared to be most of them. New sightings leveled off afterward, the cumulative curve flattening toward some theoretical asymptote. Most of the orbits were close and fast, but Sarasti projected a frequency distribution extending almost back to Pluto. We might stay out here for years and still catch the occasional new shovel nose returning from its extended foray into the void. The faster ones are pulling over 50 G's on the hairpin turn, Spindle pointed out. Meat couldn't handle that. I say they're unmanned. Meat's reinforceable, Sarasti said. If it's got that much scaffolding, you might as well stop splitting hairs and call it a machine anyway. Surface morphometrics were absolutely uniform. 400,000 divers, everyone identical. If there was an alpha male calling the shots among the herd, it couldn't be distinguished on sight. One night, as such things were measured on board, I followed a soft squeal of tortured electronics up to the observation blister. Spindle floated there, watching the skimmers. He'd closed the clamshells, blocked off the stars, and built a little analytical nest in their place. Graphs and windows spilled across the inside of the dome as though the virtual space in Spindle's head was insufficient to contain them. Tactical graphics lit him from all sides, turned his body into a bright patchwork of flickering tattoos. The illustrated man. "Mind if I come in?" I asked. He grunted. "Yeah, but not enough to push it." Inside the dome, the sound of heavy rainfall hissed and spat behind the screeching that had led me here. What is that? Ben's magnetosphere. He didn't look back. Nice, eh? Synthesists don't have opinions on the job. It keeps observer effects to a minimum. This time I permitted myself a small breach. The static's nice. I could do without the screeching. Are you kidding? That's the music of the spheres, Commissar. It's beautiful, like old jazz. I never got the hang of that, either. He shrugged and squelched the upper register, left the rain pattering around us. His jiggling eyes fixed on some arcane graphic. Want a scoop for your notes? Sure. There you go. Light reflected off his feedback glove, iridescing like the wing of a dragonfly as he pointed. An absorption spectrum, a looped time series. Bright peaks surged and subsided across a 15-second time frame. Subtitles only gave me wavelengths and angstroms. What is it? Diver farts. Those bastards are dumping complex organics into the atmosphere. How complex? Hard to tell so far. Faint traces and they dissipate like that. But sugars and aminos, at least. Maybe proteins. Maybe more. Maybe life? Microbes? An alien terraforming project. Depends on how you define life, eh? Spindle said. Not even Deinococcus would last long down there. But it's a big atmosphere. They better not be in any hurry if they're reworking the whole thing by direct inoculation. If they were, the job would go a lot faster with self-replicating inoculates.
Sounds like life to me. Sounds like agricultural aerosols is what it sounds like. Those fuckers are turning the whole damn gas ball into a rice paddy bigger than Jupiter. He gave me a scary grin. Something's got a big appetite, hmm? You gotta wonder if we aren't gonna be a teeny bit outnumbered. Spindle's findings were front and center at our next get-together. The vampire summed it up for us, visual aids dancing on the table. Von Neumann self-replicating R-selector. Seed washes up and sprouts skimmers. Skimmers harvest raw materials from the accretion belt. Some perturbation in those orbits. Belt still unsettled. Haven't seen any of the herd giving birth, Spindle remarked. Any sign of a factory? Saristi shook his head. Discarded, maybe. Decompiled. Or the herd stops breeding at optimal N. There are only the bulldozers, Bates pointed out. There'll be tenants. A lot of them, eh? Spindle added. Outnumber us by orders of mag. James. But they might not show up for centuries. Saristi clicked. Do these skimmers build fireflies? Burns Caulfield? It was a rhetorical question. Spindle answered anyway. Don't see how. Something else does then. Something already local. Nobody spoke for a moment. James's topology shifted and shuffled in silence. When she opened her mouth again, someone indefinably younger was on top. Their habitat isn't anything like ours if they're building a home way out here. That's hopeful. Michelle, the synesthete. Proteins. Sarosti's eyes were unreadable behind the visor. Comparable biochemistries. They might eat us.
Whoever these beings are, they don't even live in sunlight. No territorial overlap, no resource overlap, no basis for conflict. There's no reason we shouldn't get along just fine.
On the other hand, Spindle said, technology implies belligerence. Michelle snorted softly.
According to a coterie of theoretical historians who've never actually met an alien, yes. Maybe now we get to prove them wrong.
And in the next instant she was just gone, her affect scattered like leaves in a dust devil, and Susan James was back in her place saying, why don't we just ask them? Ask? Bates said. There are 400,000 machines out there. How do we know they can't talk?
We'd have heard, Spindle said. They're drones. Can't hurt to ping them, just to make sure.
There's no reason they should talk, even if they are smart. Language and intelligence aren't all that strongly correlated, even on Earth. Why not try, at least? James rolled her eyes. It's what we're here for. It's what I'm here for. Just send a bloody signal. After a moment, Bates picked up the ball. Bad game theory, Suze. Game theory. She made it sound like a curse. Tit for tat's the best strategy. They pinged us, we pinged back. Ball's in their court now. We send another signal, we may give away too much.
I know the rules, Amanda. They say if the other party never takes the initiative again, we ignore each other for the rest of the mission, because game theory says you don't want to look needy.
The rule only applies when you're going up against an unknown player, the Major explained. We'll have more options the more we learn. James sighed.
It's just, you all seem to be going into this assuming they'll be hostile, as if a simple hailing signal is going to bring them down on us.
Bates shrugged. It only makes sense to be cautious. I may be a jarhead, but I'm not eager to piss off anything that hops between stars and terraform super Jovians for a living. I don't have to remind anyone here that Theseus is no warship.
She'd said anyone. She'd meant Saristi.
And Saristi, focused on his own horizon, didn't answer. Not out loud, at least. But his surfaces spoke in a different tongue entirely.
Not yet, they said. Bates was right, by the way. Theseus was officially tricked out for exploration, not combat. No doubt our masters would have preferred to load her up with nukes and particle cannons as well as her scientific payload, but not even a telemattered fuel stream can change the laws of inertia. A weaponized prototype would have taken longer to build. A more massive one, laden with heavy artillery, would take longer to accelerate. Time, our masters had decided, was of greater essence than armament. In a pinch, our fabrication facilities could build most anything we needed, given time. It might take a while to build a particle beam cannon from scratch, and we might have to scavenge a local asteroid for the raw material, but we could do it, assuming our enemies would be willing to wait, in the interests of fair play. But what were the odds that even our best weapons would prove effective against the intelligence that had pulled off the firefall? If the unknown was hostile, we were probably doomed no matter what we did. The unknown was technologically advanced, and there were some who claimed that made them hostile by definition. Technology implies belligerence, they said. I suppose I should explain that, now that it's completely irrelevant. You've probably forgotten after all this time. Once there were three tribes. The optimists, whose patron saints were Drake and Sagan, believed in a universe crawling with gentle intelligence, spiritual brethren vaster and more enlightened than we, a great galactic siblinghood into whose ranks we would someday ascend. Surely, said the optimists, space travel implies enlightenment, for it requires the control of great destructive energies. Any race that can't rise above its own brutal instincts will wipe itself out long before it learns to bridge the interstellar gulf. Across from the optimists sat the pessimists, who genuflected before the graven images of Saint Fermi and a host of lesser lightweights. The pessimists envisioned a lonely universe full of dead rocks and prokaryotic slime. The odds are just too low, they insisted. Too many rogues, too much radiation, too much eccentricity in too many orbits. It is a surpassing miracle that even one Earth exists. To hope for many is to abandon reason and embrace religious mania. After all, the universe is 14 billion years old. If the galaxy were alive with intelligence, wouldn't it be here by now? Equidistant to the other two tribes sat the historians. They didn't have too many thoughts on the probable prevalence of intelligent spacefaring extraterrestrials. But if there are any, they said, they're not just going to be smart, they're going to be mean. It might seem almost too obvious a conclusion. What is human history if not an ongoing succession of greater technologies grinding lesser ones beneath their boots? But the subject wasn't merely human history, or the unfair advantage that tools gave to any given side. The oppressed snatch up advanced weaponry as readily as the oppressor, given half a chance. No, the real issue was how those tools got there in the first place. The real issue was what tools are for. To the historians, tools existed for only one reason: to force the universe into unnatural shapes. They treated nature as an enemy. They were by definition a rebellion against the way things were. Technology is a stunted thing in benign environments. It never thrived in any culture gripped by belief in natural harmony. Why invent fusion reactors if your climate is comfortable, if your food is abundant? Why build fortresses if you have no enemies? Why force change upon a world that poses no threat? Human civilization had a lot of branches not so long ago. Even into the 21st century, a few isolated tribes had barely developed stone tools. Some settled down with agriculture. Others weren't content until they had ended nature itself. Still others, until they'd built cities in space. We all rested eventually, though. Each new technology trampled lesser ones, climbed to some complacent asymptote, and stopped, until my own mother packed herself away like a larva in honeycomb, softened by machinery, robbed of incentive by her own contentment. But history never said that everyone had to stop where we did. It only suggested that those who had stopped no longer struggled for existence. There could be other, more hellish worlds where the best human technology would crumble, where the environment was still the enemy, where the only survivors were those who fought back with sharper tools and stronger empires. The threats contained in those environments would not be simple ones. Harsh weather and natural disasters either kill you or they don't, and once conquered or adapted to, they lose their relevance. No, the only environmental factors that continued to matter were those that fought back, that countered new strategies with newer ones, that forced their enemies to scale ever greater heights just to stay alive. Ultimately, the only enemy that mattered was an intelligent one. And if the best toys do end up in the hands of those who've never forgotten that life itself is an act of war against intelligent opponents, what does that say about a race whose machines travel between the stars? The argument was straightforward enough. It might even have been enough to carry the historians to victory, if such debates were ever settled on the basis of logic, and if a bored population hadn't already awarded the game to Fermi on points. But the historian paradigm was just too ugly, too Darwinian for most people, and besides, no one really cared anymore. Not even the Cassidy survey's late-breaking discoveries changed much. So what if some dirtball at Ursae Majoris Eridani had an oxygen atmosphere? It was 43 light-years away, and it wasn't talking. And if you wanted flying chandeliers and alien messiahs, you could build them to order in heaven. If you wanted testosterone and target practice, you could choose an afterlife chock full of nasty alien monsters with really bad aim. If the mere thought of an alien intelligence threatened your worldview, you could explore a virtual galaxy of empty real estate, ripe and waiting for any God-fearing earthly pilgrims who chanced by. It was all there, just the other side of a 15-minute splice job and a cervical socket. Why endure the cramped and smelly confines of real-life space travel to go visit pond scum on Europa? And so, inevitably, a fourth tribe arose, a heavenly host that triumphed over all, the tribe that just didn't give a shit. They didn't know what to do when the fireflies showed up. So they sent us, and in belated honor of the historian mantra, they sent along a warrior just in case. It was doubtful in the extreme that any child of Earth would be a match for a race with interstellar technology should they prove unfriendly. Still, I could tell that Bates's presence was a comfort, to the human members of the crew at least. If you have to go up unarmed against an angry T-Rex with a 4-digit IQ, it can't hurt to have a trained combat specialist at your side. At the very least, she might be able to fashion a pointy stick from the branch of some convenient tree.
This ends Disc 2.